Biblical Counseling and Mental Disorder Diagnosis on this edition of Truth and Love. I'm Dale Johnson, and you're listening to Truth and Love, a podcast of the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to provide biblical solutions to the problems that people face. This week on the podcast, I have with me Dr. Jen Chin. She is ACBC certified and has taught on biblical counseling at seminaries, universities, and different conferences. She's been featured on biblical counseling observation videos and recently published Biblical Counseling and Mental Disorders, which is what we are talking about today. Jen was previously licensed as a clinical psychologist in 2002 after earning a doctorate in clinical psychology and a master's degree in marriage and family therapy from Christian institutions. She was formerly trained in evidence-based practices and psychotherapy. However, midway through her psychologist's career, Jen ended up receiving biblical counseling, after which she returned to school for a master's in biblical counseling, and she left the secular world of mental health to practice biblical counseling. Jen, so wonderful to know you. I've enjoyed the time the Lord has allowed us to share together and getting to know you and your story, and really eager to see the fruit that the Lord has produced in you, and particularly as you talk about in this book. And so welcome to the podcast. Looking forward to our time together today.
Me too.
Now, I confess we are a little behind on this one, but I was trying to save this for Mental Health Awareness Month. So we're looking at the month of May now. That is the time where the secular world acknowledges mental health awareness. And what we try and do on the podcast is revisit ideas that come directly from the mental health world. And I wanted to save this discussion for this week and this month during Mental Health Awareness Month. And so we're going to talk about your book, which was released last October at our ACBC annual conference. And I'm looking forward to the discussion today where we're talking about your book that has been released, which has sold very well. There's a lot of intrigue. And I think the effort that you put into it, the Lord is truly blessing. So let's get into talking about this issue of the DSM. I like to ask authors, because I'm always just intrigued, a book just doesn't happen, right? A book comes about by a story, a backstory, like where there's a certain interest or something that intrigued you, or now is the right time, you were seeing a gap, whatever the case might be. I just want to hear how this particular book that you've written with Shepherd's Press came together and you took on this project. So what was the intrigue?
It started out with conversations with Dr. Ernie Baker, who actually is the editor for the Critical Issues in Biblical Counseling series. And he would ask me a question about diagnoses or talk to me about one of his counselees with a particular diagnosis. And I'd share with him something. And over time, he's like, you should write a book on that. And I would just laugh. I think the more that I heard in biblical counseling, people using the DSM terms and recognizing there was a big difficulty in truly understanding what the DSM is versus what it seems to be. And so I just wanted it to be clear to especially biblical counselors of to not be intimidated by labels used by the DSM and that somehow we need to give it up to the professionals once somebody has a label.
That's really helpful because I think it is for the layperson very intimidating. And when you hear labels like this, it comes with this concept that there's a disease, which I want us to talk about in a little bit. But before we get into even to the talking or criticizing perspectives of the DSM, how it's used, that sort of thing, I think it's important to know, like, what in the world is this thing? Some people have heard us maybe talk about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Just talk a little bit about what it is so that people are aware of what we're describing, and then we'll get into some of the contents of your book and why this was an important subject for us as biblical counselors to even think about.
Definitely. The purpose of the DSM is great. You know, that they really want to be able to communicate with each other about a group of symptoms and a label because they want to be able to identify what is going on and then study causes and development treatment for it. So they're really trying to address suffering in the world. And when I'm talking about labels, I'm not trying to say people aren't suffering and having different things hurting going on. I'm not saying what they're experiencing isn't real. It's more of these labels are man-made and have a lot of faults with them. Given what they're trying to do, it's a very arduous task and yet it does fall short, but is their best efforts at this point in time?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at the history, the technical term, which I know you know, I'll just inform our listeners, you taught this for many more years than I've taught this. What we're talking about is a nosology. Nosology is just a study of categorization. And you're exactly right. This is what the secular world wanted to do, was to create categories where there would be common language, because what was happening in the asylum, there was so much confusion about, and they just wanted to have similar language that they could talk about if there were any breakthroughs in some sort of treatment or ways that could help different issues that people were seeing. And so over time, you see this develop. The first official DSM, which we see in the Western world, was 1952. It's progressed now to where DSM-5, and we're on the revision of the DSM-5. And it's expanded dramatically. The book that you're particularly describing in its current state is about 1,000 pages, give or take 500 diagnoses, something like that. So these are criteria-based, what's called criteria-based approaches. So they're giving, as you mentioned, labels. They're giving diagnostic labels that have criteria written in them, where those are expressions of the things people experience. And as you mentioned, I think that's a noble task, wanting to try and catalog in some way what people are experiencing, trying to use similar language. But in the 1980s, we saw this massive shift where it was not just something psychiatrists and psychologists used in their desk drawer, right, as common language. Somehow, through biopsychiatry and pharmaceutical involvement, this became a book now that is well known in the public. And it's definitely utilized in the public sphere, which is a part of what you're describing as the danger of some of the labels. So what I want to get into now is talking about when people use the term a mental health diagnosis, what are we actually trying to communicate when people use this? And maybe you can say what the mental health world intends with the DSM versus the way that it's often utilized in more of a disease type model. So just describe that concept.
So when someone is given a label, it is saying that somehow from the person happened to interview them, saw these signs and symptoms, and basically this constellation of signs and symptoms that fits under this particular label. There, it may point to something, a mental disorder underneath, and mental meaning it is affecting what we think, what we feel, what we do, which we know is actually describes the biblical heart. So it is not necessarily these things that when you have these certain symptoms, you then check it off the list and say, oh yes, now they have this disorder. So another mistake that is very common is, okay, now I have clinical depression. Now I therefore have this biomedical disease, right? Instead of now becoming from this constellation of symptoms, it's now become this clinical word that needs to be treated by professionals and possibly medication, versus this is the particular label they are using to try to communicate about the symptoms that are hanging together with you. But one of the problems too is that there is such a huge overlap with so many of the symptoms that you don't even know, is this major depression or actually generalized anxiety disorder? And there were actually studies that showed there's so much, there's like 80% overlap of some of the symptoms. And so is it two different things? Is it one thing? Is it a bunch of different things and they all look similar? And so there's this language that is trying to clarify, but sometimes it ends up distorting and or magnifying one part and then obscuring something else. But then also then coming to the assumption of because it is treated with a psychotropic medication, therefore now it is biomedical. So that is one of the big difficulties or the big confusions of I have mental illness, that somehow there is a disease process or an illness process going on somehow biologically. And not to say, you know, our emotions are whole body, but does that mean that now it can almost translate into now it's my neurotransmitters or now it's my brain injury or now it's, I mean, not to say that there is TBI, which is very real and has symptoms associated with it and suffering, but a lot of these labels are not biomedical in nature. And then the treatment, when it's described medically, then the treatment becomes medical. And so things even like disordered sexuality have now become mental illnesses almost to the point where, well, it's something we have to accept because it is an illness. And then there's no morality, no moral agency for that. For example, pedophilia is in the DSM as a mental illness.
And you're going to see that you bring that up. You're going to see very quickly, because there's a strong movement in the direction of decriminalizing this concept. And so I would predict that, you know, at some point in the future, we'll see, very similarly to the story that we saw with homosexuality, where it was removed from the DSM, which is a whole different issue. We're going to see something like pedophilia removed from the DSM as if it's some sort of disorder. You're going to see it decriminalized, because once you jump down this slippery slope of sexuality and you label it a certain way, now it becomes free reign to whatever preferences a person has. So very helpful in describing the sort of biomedical perspective, that when you get a label, many people just assume that this is some sort of illness. Now that you have a label, there's an understood cause. Most people relate that cause to being something biomedical. How do we know people assume that? It's because they, as you mentioned, they offer medicine, and that medicine is intended to fix or repair something that's happening in the brain chemically or whatever. That's sort of how the story goes in a broad sense. So the DSM has really become something that is, you know, trying to label diseases. And even they describe that they hope that it leads to a fully informed treatment plan and this sort of thing. And so it has become a part of the common language that we see consistently in our culture. And it's something that's become very confusing, because here we're describing the difference between, yes, absolutely, people experience despair. People experience anxiety. People experience ebbs and flows, even drastically and dramatically and quickly, from mania to despair. We experience those things. Those things are real experiences, but now we've labeled them, provided explanatory power through this thing called the DSM. And now it's taken on a medical model approach. And we have a tendency to think very differently about what it is that we have, or just what it is that we're experiencing. And those are two different things. So I want you to help us to understand, as you do in the book, I think very clearly, what the DSM is or what it's accomplishing, and really what it's not, because it's trying to do certain things, but it's also not trying to do certain things. And I think we need to make clear what that is. And Jen, here's why I think this book that you've written is so important. What I see more and more happening in the biblical counseling movement is an ascendancy of the labels and language of the DSM, just as you mentioned, where people are giving credit much more to the framing of the DSM. People are giving credit much more to the labels of the DSM, and almost giving credit toward those labels, where the Bible then has to answer a person's experience according to that mental health label, as opposed to saying what I hear you describing, that this experience is actually better explained through the scripture versus this secular document where it's been misunderstood. So help us to understand what the DSM actually is as a cultural document that's trying to use common language, and then what it's not, some of its limitations. That'd be helpful.
Right. So it's intended to be able to communicate about symptoms that hang together and give them a label. And then sometimes it's ended up using for billing, for communication, for being able to get a certain number of treatments, whether a certain medication. So if a person is getting a certain psychotropic medication, it has to fit within the diagnoses that that type of medication treats.
And then the protocol that comes with it. Let me back up. You mentioned something, and you said this because it just rolls off your tongue. And I want to make sure that we clarify. You talked about symptoms that are grouped together. Now, I want to dive into that just a little bit, and then I want you to continue talking about what the DSM is. This is a really important distinction, because symptoms that go together, this is actually the definition of mental disorder, right? It's a collection of symptoms, which is known as a syndrome. Syndromes are simply a collection of symptoms. They are not describing etiology or cause. So I think what you're saying that it's doing, that's a really helpful distinction, because I think so many people misunderstand. They take the DSM as if it's some sort of physician's desk reference, and that we know, you know, clearly what the cause is of this depression. It's because serotonin is this, or anxiety is because of this. And so we have to make that distinction clear. You're giving a clear articulation to say these things are symptoms lumped together, That's actually what the proper definition of a mental disorder, quote unquote, mental disorder is. And they're not claiming anything more than that, even though it's used differently. So continue on sort of with that thought.
Yeah, but back to what you said. Yeah, very, it's a mere description. And it is based on the person who interviewed you, because what can happen is another person might interview you and actually give you a different label or labels, because you can get more than one of them.
That is so important. You said this earlier, and I just think it's so important that people not miss that, is what we're talking about in getting these quote unquote diagnoses are not, you know, blood testing. There's not that sort of medical engagement. We're doing interviews. It's very subjective. And this has been one of the biggest critiques from a secular scientific perspective, is how scientific is this? Is it testable and retestable? If you were to do this interview, right, you said, well, I think this person has X. And then another psychologist would do the interview and they say, well, I think it could be this one or this diagnosis. And you're seeing that lack of consistency. That's been one of the greatest criticisms within psychiatry and psychology that we know of the DSM, as a part of this what's called diagnostic inflation that's happening and the lack of scientific vigor and consistency. So that's a really important piece of the puzzle that you're bringing to the surface that people maybe skip over very quickly. So yeah.
Right. And this is what the secular folks are saying, not the VIVOL counselors. It's to the point where people who are president of the National Institute of Mental Health, which is, you know, one of the highest positions in the field of mental health, saying the DSM is not valid, and meaning there it's not necessarily describing things correctly, and then it is not reliable, meaning we're not all talking about the same thing when we think we are, and therefore we don't even think we can do research using the DSM. The National Institute of Mental Health, actually with the DSM-5, has now developed their own new nomenclature, nosology, because they don't think the DSM is scientific enough. And yet people go to a doctor, psychologist, mental health professional and get this label and then believe, okay, this is what I have. And now because they say I have this, and now this is what I'm supposed to do. And it has to come from a mental health professional because they know what's going on.
That's so important to offer that clarity there. You talk a little bit in the book, as you summarize what the DSM is, you talk about the biopsychosocial framework, which I think is very interesting. That's under unbelievable scrutiny today, the whole concept of the biopsychosocial model, but maybe we shouldn't go in that direction. But you talk a little bit about the heuristic, the concept of a heuristic framework. Describe what they're trying to accomplish with the DSM and what it really is there.
So they're not trying to give a definitive, okay, this is major depression. I mean, they want to, because that would really help with research, but it's more of a rule of thumb of this looks like this. This is a framework, but there isn't a cause for it. And that for some reason, it is part of how the bio, the psycho, and the social come together, which is why the clinical interview is so necessary, because you're kind of thinking through, wait, how might biology contribute to these symptoms, the person's psychology, their cognitions, their inner world, and then culturally, how is this all fit to why they might be experiencing these symptoms? And so that's then to all the subjectivity of it.
And I think that's really key. You're highlighting that part, the subjectivity. I want you to give me a thought. You use this sort of language in the book, where you describe the DSM, trying to give credit for what it's actually doing. You say you use the concept of a rough, culturally attuned guide. So describe a little bit about that concept of it's a culturally attuned guide. And I guess the reason that intrigues me is because you can't take the DSM and let's go to India and implement the DSM, right? It is a culturally attuned guide. So flesh that out a little bit.
Yes. So, I mean, just thinking too about this, I don't want to overgeneralize, but there can be general commonalities in how different cultures might express themselves. You know, so I come from a Japanese American background, and my expression of emotions may be a little more muted. And then having worked in the African American community, it's almost the extreme. So if somebody is expressing something very loudly, and you're not from that community, you could think, oh, they're just hysterical, right? And they could look at me and think, oh, she's just so repressed and something's wrong because she's not able to express herself. And so that same sign or symptom is influenced by the cultural glasses that we're wearing.
I think that's so helpful because what's normal in our culture might not be normal in other cultures. And we do see that we prize and label things according to culturally what we think is normal and abnormal. And yet we now move in a direction of, as you mentioned, to try and say that this is biomedical. Let's finish today because I want to bring you back. There's so much more to talk about in your book that I think is really helpful. Let's finish today talking about what the DSM is not. We've alluded to some of this stuff, but even though the culture has a concept of what they think the DSM is trying to accomplish, we need to make some clear demarcations of, even though it's communicated in a certain way that these labels mean that you have something, let's make a distinction of what the DSM is actually not. You talk about this in terms of diagnosis. You talk about this in terms of it's not presenting a biomedical perspective and so on. So just help us to understand a little bit about what the DSM is not doing or what it can't really do for us.
Right. So other than a very few limited in the neurocognitive disorders area, it's not that they're not biomedical disorders. And I'm not saying there's no biology involved whatsoever.
Jen, I think what you just said is really important is you're making a distinction to say that what's happening here, we're not saying that the body's not involved. That's a really important distinction. Some people say, well, if you're denying that mental disorders happen or that we're denying that the body's involved, nobody is saying that the body's not involved. But we have to make sure that we keep clear, just because something is reflected in the body doesn't mean it's caused by the body. That's a really important distinction. That demonstrates biblically that there's a holism that's happening. And the Bible makes clear that anthropology flows from the inside out. So obviously, when the heart is moving and active in certain directions, the body will be consistent with the disposition of our heart. And so when we think, believe in a certain direction, it's going to be reflected in our body because we're holistic. The body is operating according to the design that God gave it. And so, of course, there's destruction of the body. It's not determinative in the same way as the heart is on the outer man expression. And that's really important. So I appreciate that you're distinguishing between identifiable biomedical influences, bodily decay of neurocognitive type issues. But then we're also recognizing most of what's in the DSM is not that. We're describing something that's a part of experience. It does express itself in the body. So we're not denying that that happens, but we're just trying to say that the cultural narrative of cause from the body is not the proper explanation and hasn't been demonstrated scientifically.
Exactly. It's not scientific to say when a lot of mental diagnoses, oh, this means I have a disordered mind biologically.
Very good. I want to make sure that you come back next week and join us, finish talking about a little bit about your book. And one of the things I'm going to ask you next week is what it is that you hope to accomplish in the writing of this book. What is it you hope people would look into? So hopefully you've enjoyed today and enjoyed our time with Jen, and we'll look forward to being with her again next week. You're listening to Truth and Love, a podcast of ACBC. You know, I'm so grateful to Jen and her work on this particular book, and also for Ernie Baker and Shepherd's Press putting in so much time and effort to create the Critical Issues in Biblical Counseling series. And as you may know, this is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we always like to provide helpful resources that discern with a biblical lens many of the popular ideologies surrounding mental health. And so we have a resource page linked in the show notes that are dedicated to many podcasts that we've done over the years regarding this topic of mental health that is so popular in our culture. Past topics we've discussed include mental health, the mental health construct, and mental illness narrative. You still hear those terms passed around all over the place. We've talked about many popular diagnoses, including anxiety, depression, OCD, schizophrenia, ADHD. We have covered several therapeutic approaches, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, emotionally focused therapy, EMDR, and trauma-informed therapy, all things that you're hearing at a popular level today. I'm excited about the podcast that we have coming up this month and pray that you find them helpful. as you seek to discern so many things with biblical wisdom. You can always look for more resources like we talked about today on our website, biblicalcounseling.com.